Welcome to the Global from Asia podcast, where the daunting process of running an international business from Hong Kong is broken down into straight up actionable advice. And now, your host, Michael Michelini.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of Global from Asia. I'm getting myself settled back here at my home in Asia, in Shenzhen, and getting over some jet lag after that last month going all around America on a roadshow. And just back from Hong Kong, spent a couple of days there, and, you know, the normal routine of a cross-border business life, hopping Hong Kong and Shenzhen. So actually, lots of episodes just about the border crossing itself we can do in the future. All right, now for today's episode, we are at episode 22, and today is the second part of a two-part series with my good friend Attila. While we were in Dallas, Texas, we had recorded a second interview, and while the first one was around cash flow management and business management and some lessons there, today we're talking about his experience of buying and sourcing electronics accessories from China through both Hong Kong and globally. So some strategies he's used and first-hand experiences. So while, you know, I think some of this might be opinion and some of it might be just different experiences and people that you meet randomly, I hope people get a really good value. Attila was really kind enough to share his guts and keep us all really on edge of our seats on this episode. So I hope you guys enjoy. Okay, Attila, so thank you again for coming back on the show. And now, the manufacturing in China mindset is kind of like the first topic on our episode today. And a lot of people always kind of like get excited about buying, you know, really low-priced products direct from China and selling in the U.S. for like a big margin and getting rich. I mean, I think maybe Attila thought that. I definitely thought that. But maybe you should just kind of get these guys into the right mindset before we even start talking about the details.
So first things first, when you get to China, you'll be brought to a factory or an office, and many times they will want to bring you to dinner or party or this or that, and you will want to avoid many of these. Try to avoid the luxurious dinners and parties that they invite you to, as they will eventually increase the price or lower the quality of the product that you're attempting to purchase.
I want to maybe add is don't be gullible. I think I am American myself, and I think I used to be very gullible. Okay, next question is, I've done buying from China. You know, I don't think I'm very good at it, but I never did electronics. I did some little bit of LED for a bar. I did the people that might know me know I did like bar products or home and gifts. So I you're more in the electronics world, and I think that's something that we're going to focus on this podcast is electronics. You know, I think listeners should understand that every industry is very different. I mean, electronics especially is hard because it's such a rapidly changing and developed industry, right? So you can't sit on stock too long, and price, the inventory value just dives. The longer you hold something, the price just drops. I was a little bit more spoiled. I mean, I've had stock for years in warehouses, and the value's pretty much the same. With electronics, it's different. So do you want to maybe...
Well, the difference between bar products and consumer electronics is different because of the rapidly changing technologies. Like, say, for instance, a Bluetooth receiver that's on your ear, that will change every roughly 8 to 12 months. There will be every month there will be 100 new designs out on the market. And you can't sell them all. You can't cover them all. You know, you pick the good companies or the good designs with the good quality at good price, and you sell those. As in terms of bar products, there's very few innovation in that industry versus Bluetooth or speakers or computer products and these type of technology and industries that change every other day.
So I think on top of that makes it the sourcing of the components or the suppliers very difficult. And I don't even know the answer to this, but, you know, a tablet, you just find a tablet factory, or should you really find all the pieces of the tablet?
Well, the problem with tablets is there's so many of them out there. You know, there's so many functions, there's features, specs, companies, brands, that you really just need to find one good company, make sure that they have stock, make sure that they're planning on selling it for the next 2 to 3 months, and purchase a sample. Make sure the quality is fine and begin selling it. You know, you can purchase 25, 50, 100 pieces. Many times the companies will require a large MOQ, but if you've lived in China long enough, you can negotiate this MOQ. MOQ is minimum order quantity.
So then you then would just find the final supplier, right? Just to kind of summarize the answer.
Well, the funny thing about electronics is they have an electronic market in Shenzhen, China, and there's a lot of small companies, mid-sized companies, and large companies. And the whole things about electronics are, you have, take a look at the components. You have the case, you have the PCB, you have the motherboard, you have the LCD. That's it. So you've got these small, mid-sized, and large companies. They're all assembling these tablets. Now, the only thing differentiating from one another is the quality of the components that they use on the PCB. How well do they assemble them? And what kind of guarantee or warranty do they give with them? A lot of the smaller companies, chances are they will only give you maybe a week to a month. Mid-sized companies and larger-sized companies, they'll give you 3 to 6 months.
Got it. Okay. So the next topic here is dealing with engineers that design the product. If I know it's kind of like changing the gear here, because talking about like this is like designing a new product, where I think the previous kind of questions have been about an existing product, but maybe high level, because I think this is a whole nother podcast or many, many podcasts just designing a product. But, you know, that's the point I have here is dealing with engineers to design a new product. What do you recommend?
Well, it really depends on what kind of product you're designing. If it's a electronic product that requires PCBs and coding and this and that, my advice is don't hire a engineer in China if you value your products. I might be a little emotional on this topic because I've hired several engineers in China and my products would continuously be backdoored in China, sold to the market in China. I no longer do it.
Okay, so I know previously in the last couple of questions we were talking more about pre-existing products that maybe are in the catalog of a factory, but if you want to design your own product and if you're not an engineer yourself, and you need to design that product, what do you recommend?
Well, many companies in China, many factories in China will have their own engineers in their company, and they will offer them to design your products or design your coding or this and that. My advice would be is do not do that. Keep everything separate. You don't want everything under one roof so that your unique product or your special product that you've spent countless hours designing or making to end up in the Chinese market or selling to other customers overseas.
So yeah, I think the quick summary there is, you know, the more you break up your supply chain, the more value you add to yourself. So that if you have multiple suppliers and you yourself are managing them, of course it's more work for you, but that's more value for your supply chain. It's more value you're adding and it's protecting yourself more. If you put everything in one factory, you're putting your trust there, which, you know, if you trust, of course, that's great, and if there's never any problems, then you're very lucky. But if there is a problem,
why take the risk?
Yeah, exactly. Why take that risk? You know, as a business, you want to reduce risk. So having everything in one, all your eggs in one basket is a higher risk. The next topic here is pricing. I know you're very familiar with your industry in the electronics world, and I know you gave me keywords like BOM or BOM or bill of materials. Maybe you can just kind of give some ideas how you negotiate and calculate price with companies.
So before dealing with factories, I find the product, I take it apart, I find out how much the injected plastic or how much to paint it or how much PCB or the components, you know, I take the components apart, make a BOM, a build of materials, call it a BOM, which they don't take very kindly here in America. But before going into the factory, I have all that ready. And say, for instance, if a product costs $15 to make, and they're asking $22. I know I have about a roughly $4 to $5 to negotiate. Whether I'll achieve that or not depends on the company, if they have stock or not. Many factories will oftentimes produce 10,000 or sometimes even 20,000 pieces of quantity to reduce the cost of manufacture. Depending if they have stock or not, it gives you a little bit of a leeway. If they don't have stock, then chances are they're going to be requiring a large MOQ, like 1,000 or 5,000 pieces. If they do have stock, then the cards are in your favor.
I think it's kind of a cool podcast because I have a little bit of experience in the home and good or bar products, and you're more on the electronics So I kind of can give my perspective. You know, our next topic is MOQ, or minimum order quantity, which Tilly mentioned earlier. So I think in my industry is a little bit different, and maybe I'll explain my perspective and then you can give yours. So in my world, when I was doing with bar products, it's a much lower volume kind of business. And while the stock doesn't expire as fast, the stock doesn't sell as fast. And it also means that there's less players and there's less buyers. So if I wanted to buy some bottle openers, I couldn't. They usually didn't have stock because they would only make what they need to make when the customer ordered. And I think I knew my suppliers pretty well. And I believe them. I've seen their factories. I see their stock rooms. So they just didn't have these in stock. So I would either have to make the minimum order to make it worth their while, I think. Right. I think it's true. Like, it's to make it worth their while to do that production run, because they gotta train their staff to do the assembly or do the production, and they gotta get the raw materials, and there might be minimums on the raw materials if they're doing a special material. So in my world, it seemed like I couldn't really just kind of get pre-existing stock. What I could do is tell them if I wasn't in a rush, when another customer ordered, they would let me know, and then I can get a smaller order in while they're doing that run. So maybe you can talk about MOQ in electronics for listeners, you know, dealing with this industry.
So visiting factories is kind of like a poker game. So you have to analyze every situation, you know, whether or not they're the actual factory making it. You can visit a factory and they will sell maybe 300 products, but in reality, they will only manufacture 10 or 20, which means they have 10 or 20 injection mold sets, and they're the ones actually making the PCBs and assembly and everything. All the other products, they're just basically partnered with other factories in the area or so forth, and just reselling products, because why not? I mean, if you're purchasing video game accessories or mobile accessories, you would most likely be interested in such and such products. So many times, if they're making those 10 to 20 products, they will have stock. Otherwise, if not, they will require an MOQ. Depending if they're low on stock, even on the products that they do make, they might require a MOQ because it costs an X amount of money to make.
Okay, so hopefully that gives some people more ideas of what this MOQ. A lot of times if you're getting a quotation from a supplier, they'll put MOQ and how many pieces are required. So maybe people can get a little bit more perspective there. So usually after you get a quotation and you get the price, I think the next is a sample, right? Usually in this kind of process. So what do you recommend people with sampling?
I would recommend to get more than two or three pieces of samples. If it's a very low price product, I would say get about 20 to 30 pieces and just randomly test them. And the problem is with technology changes in a rapid pace that you don't really have too much time to spend. The best bet would be to take apart parts, look at the components, look at what chips they're using. If they're using a low-end component, then you can request them to change out certain components in them. But it's a little difficult if they already have stock and you're wanting to purchase from that stock. You just have to have faith.
Yeah, faith is very important. I'm still not very patient, but I've gotten much more patient doing business overseas. So say I accept these samples and I'm ready to place my order. I think the next is a contract, and I know you have some pretty passionate feelings about a contract, but maybe you can share that with the listeners.
Contracts are not worth the paper they're written on. In China, basically anything goes. If you try to enforce a contract, you will spend a lot of time, a lot of money in courts, and chances are you will end up in nowhere. My advice is, if you have a contract, write it in Chinese. Make sure it's legible in Chinese and that the official company name, that their Chinese name is in that.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked on the last episode about contracts with business partners. And, you know, I think a lot of times contracts serve, I believe, two purposes. Everyone thinks about the value, you know, in court and suing and all this stuff. But a lot of times it never actually happens. Even in America, I believe that doesn't even happen that much because of the, you know, the difficulties and the size, you know, how much value it is in it. But I believe the second purpose of a contract is the communication. And just make sure that both parties of the contract understand the same thing.
The best way is to visit the factory, talk to them face to face, communicate very clearly that this is what I want, and this is what we're looking to get, you know, which is a long-term relationship, this is not just a one-time order. We're looking to continuously sell these products, and we can prosper together. And when you say certain keywords and certain, you know, they see you face to face, so they will take you more seriously when you communicate more properly. Many companies overseas, they come over here, they take a look at the product, they negotiate the price, which doesn't really differ much from the email price, and they shake hands and go their ways. And when the product's done and finished and they pick it up and things aren't the way they discussed, things don't really feel very copacetic. And that's where many foreigners who come to China and purchase products fall into a dilemma, because they don't communicate properly that the long-term relationship will be beneficial to not only them, but also to both parties as well.
You know, we've mentioned contracts, and I mentioned that last episode with Attila in episode 21, we talked about, you know, business partners. You know, even though they're not an equity partner in your company, your supplier is very critical to the success of your business. So, you know, you don't look at them as just as like a price or cheap. You know, you want them in for the long term. You know, you don't want to keep changing your supplier if you don't have to. So,
and that's very important, that you portray that they're your business partner, that you are both going to be on this venture together, that you will both be profiting together on this. And you really don't want to nickel and dime them to death. Like I mentioned earlier, you know, I like to take a lot of products apart and find out their costs. You got to leave enough margin in them for labor, for rent, and everything else, so that they get to eat as well.
Okay, so kind of give a basic idea of contracts. Well, you do use contracts. I mean, you have to use some kind of contracts, right? So do you do a purchase order, an invoice?
We do a basic purchase order in Chinese language, because that's what's make it official. Now, make sure that the company stamp is a round red stamp with the company name on it.
So yeah, purchase order in Chinese. Okay. And then payment terms. I know this depends on the size of the order and the type of product, but if you want to give us a quick rundown of some cases there.
Well, you've got various payment terms. If it's a small order, you many times don't need to really give a deposit. You just go there, pick it up, pay them cash. If it's a slightly larger order, then you'll pay a deposit. And when the goods are finished, you go there, pay them cash, or make a bank transfer to their company account or whichever account they prefer. Quote, quote, tax reasons. If it's a very large order, let's say a 20-foot or 40-foot container, or possibly several containers, then you make a LC, letter of credit. You definitely need a more, how do I say, extended contract that describes the products, that describes the quality, that describes the warranty, describes the price, the quantity, the delivery date, and if they fall beyond the delivery date, whether they're not, there will be penalties. You go to your bank, you create a letter of credit. It's they call it an LC. Once LC has been provided by the bank, you give it to the factory, they begin your order, and once it's done, they put it in a container. But prior to container, you can put in your contract. It's very important that you put in your contract that you examine the goods. You have someone from your company examine the goods. Make sure you, from my personal experience, you examine more than several boxes, random products, just to make sure that they're working and copacetic. Once everything is copacetic, get a bill of lading, which is you get after the products, the containers have been processed through the shipping agents, and then they will get their money through the LC that you've given them prior to.
That's a lot of information there, and maybe people in listening are in different stages. I've actually never done an LC, and so that's I'm learning a little bit there. And
it's really a lot of fun. You go to the bank and wait several hours.
We all love waiting in lines in banks. I think some listeners are smaller buyers that have never been to China or Asia, that are dealing on Alibaba, that are getting Excel spreadsheets emailed to them with, you know, prices and pictures.
Now, there's nothing wrong with dealing with smaller quantities, but I do want to warn that the larger and larger purchases that you make, you may want to make a more secure payment eventually, just for your own purpose, for your own security.
So, kind of going back to you were saying about payment terms in cash, I don't think they can pay in cash. Well, I guess they can do Western Union or credit card or PayPal.
I don't recommend Western Union. There's no guaranteed protection on your behalf.
Yeah. I mean, Western Union is a little bit dangerous in the fact that once it's sent, it's sent, and they don't have to do anything after if they don't want to. So you have no power. So that, you know, we're almost at, we're kind of like going between the second and third, the second to the last question here and the last question I have. But what do you recommend somebody that's not able to go to China or have small orders, you know, paying in cash? You mentioned for a payment term on a smaller quantity. What do they do? How do they do it?
Well, it really depends on the quantity. I mean, if it's a really small quantity, then take the risk. You may be risking maybe $500 to a couple thousand dollars. But if it's over several thousand dollars, I would recommend you find a person that's local in China, that's Chinese, either a company or a personal base that you form a relation with that can act as your agent. They can go there, verify the goods, and then make payments when everything is copacetic.
All right. So my final question here is, you know, because I've known we both have had this, is a lot of times we got that first big order and the quality and the price and the terms all kind of clear. And then the second order, you think all you do is just say, do more at this amount. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of people make, and maybe you can explain why.
Well, the things that a lot of companies overseas don't realize is in China, everything is based off a cost factor. So let's say your first order cost $1.50. Your second order, the materials may have raised slightly. Maybe the injection molding or maybe the paint. Maybe the oil prices have risen. And when the oil prices have risen, everything has risen from the injections, because oil uses in every machine, you know, from paint machines to injection machines to printing machines when you print the packaging. So oil affects everything, also including the shipping, for example. But moving, not getting too elaborate here, prices do change time to time, and it's not about the supplier getting greedy or, well, sometimes it is, but many times it's not. It's about the actual costs, and you know, this will increase, that will increase, this will increase, and unfortunately that cost is passed on to you. And while that may seem misleading to you, it's the reality that costs have increased, materials have increased, labor has increased, or various other costs have increased. So don't be too, you know, shocked that if it happens to you.
I think on the return orders, price also changes, but I think you gotta also keep on top of the quality. Because I know people just kind of get comfortable that the quality was good in that first order, and then maybe the factory knows how to make it. But I think you still also got to keep on top of that and don't get too comfortable either, right? I mean, is that what, maybe it's different in your industry, but I just would recommend also you don't get lazy on checking a product. And that's a wrap. I mean, if you want to reach out to Attila, we'll put his contact info on the show notes. And that's it. Thank you for being here, Attila. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye. So there you have it, guys. Thanks, Attila, for your kind sharing of your real and deep experience and knowledge. Hope everybody else liked that raw reality. So while some of these interviews are a little bit juicy and interesting, I hope everybody is enjoying them, and feedback's always appreciated. Next week, we're working on getting Chris Gormley back on the show. We're going to do an episode about how to get a Hong Kong credit card for your international business. So I know that's a hot topic, and a lot of people have been asking me. So we're listening, and we'll release that one next week. All right, guys. Thanks again for tuning in.
To get more info about running an international business via Hong Kong, please visit our website at www.globalfromasia.com. That's www.globalfromasia.com. Also, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes feed. Thanks for tuning in.